Chapter 11. Questions and an Oath. The air in the huge stable smelled of old hay and horse dung, and blood and burned flesh. With all the doors closed, the air felt thick. Two lanterns gave little light, and shadows filled most of the interior. In the long rows of stalls, horses whickered nervously. The man hanging by his wrists from a roof beam gave a low moan, then a ragged cough. His head fell down on his chest. He was a tall man, well-muscled, if rather the worse for wear. Abruptly, Savannah realized that his chest no longer moved. The gem-studded rings on her fingers glittered red and green as she gestured curtly to Riala. The flame-haired woman pushed the man's head up and thumbed back one eyelid, then pressed an ear to his chest, careless of the still smoldering splinters that peppered him. With a sound of disgust, she straightened. "He is dead. We should have left this to the maidens, Savannah, or the Black Eyes. I do not doubt we killed him by ignorance." Savannah's mouth tightened, and she shifted her shawl in a clatter of bracelets. They ran nearly to her elbows, a noticeable weight in gold and ivory and gems, yet she would have worn everyone she owned if she could. None of the other women said anything. Putting prisoners to the question was not the work of wise ones, but Riala knew why they had to do this themselves. The lone survivor of 10 mounted men who thought they could defeat 20 maidens because they rode horses, the man had also been the first Shan-Chan captured in the 10 days since their arrival in this land. "He would have lived if he had not fought the pain so hard, Riala," Somerin said finally, shaking her head. "A strong man for a wetlander, but he could not accept pain. Still, he told us much." Savannah eyed her sideways, trying to see whether she hid sarcasm. As tall as most men, Somerin wore more bracelets and necklaces than any woman there except Savannah herself, layers of firedrops and emeralds, rubies and sapphires, almost concealing a too full bosom that otherwise would have been half bared with her blouse undone almost to her skirt. Her shawl, tied around her waist, hid nothing. At times it was difficult for Savannah to tell whether Somerin was copying her or competing with her. "Much!" Mara exclaimed. In the light of the lantern she held, her long face was grimmer than usual, though that hardly seemed possible. Mara could find the dark side of the noonday sun. "That his people lie 2 days west in the city called Amador? We knew that. All he has told us are wild tales. Arter Hawkwing. Bah! The maidens should have kept him and done what was needed." "Would you risk letting everyone learn too much too soon?" Savannah bit her lip in vexation. She had almost called them "you fools." Too many already knew too much, in her opinion, wise ones among them, but she could not risk offending these women. That knowledge grated on her. "The people are frightened." There was no need to hide her contempt for that, at least. What shocked her, outraged her, was not that they were afraid, but how few made any effort to hide the fact. Black Eyes or Stone Dogs or even maidens would have talked of what he said. You know they would. His lies would only have spread more fear. They had to be lies. In Savannah's mind, a sea was like the lakes she had seen in the wetlands, but with its far side beyond sight. If hundreds of thousands more of his people were coming, even from the other side of so large a body of water, the other prisoners she had questioned would have known of them, and no prisoner was questioned without her present. Tion raised the second lantern and regarded her with unblinking gray eyes. Nearly a head shorter than Somerin, Tion was still taller than Savannah, and twice as wide. Her round face often appeared placid, but thinking her so was a mistake. "They are right to fear," she said in a stony voice. "I am afraid and take no shame in it. The Shan-Chan are many if they are no more than took Amador, and we are few. You have your sept around you, Savannah, but where is my sept? Your wetlander friend Kadar and his tame Aes Sedai sent us through his holes in the air to die. Where are the rest of the Shido?" Riala moved to stand defiantly beside Tion, and they were quickly drawn by Alaris, even now toying with her black hair to draw attention to it. Or perhaps it was to avoid meeting Savannah's eyes. After a moment, a scowling Mara added herself to the cluster, and then Modara. Modara might have been called slim if she were not even taller than Somerin. As it was, lean was the best that could be said of her. Savanna had thought Modara as firmly in her grasp as any of the rings on her fingers, as firmly in her grasp as... Somerin looked at her and sighed, looked at the others. Slowly she walked over to stand beside them. Savanna was left standing on the very edge of the lantern's light. Of all the women tied to her by the killing of Desane, she trusted these most. Not that she trusted anyone very far, of course, but Somerin and Modara she had been sure were hers, as tightly as if they had sworn water oath to follow where she led. And now they dared face her with accusing eyes. Even Alarice looked up from playing with her hair. Savanna met their stares with a cool smile just short of a sneer. Now, she decided, was not the time to remind them of the crime that bound their fates together. Not the bludgeon this time. "I suspected Kadar might try to betray us," she said instead. Riala's blue eyes widened at the admission, and Tion opened her mouth. Savanna went on, not leaving them room to speak. "Would you rather have remained in Kinslayer's dagger to be destroyed? To be hunted like animals by four clans whose wise ones know how to make those holes without the traveling boxes? Instead, we are in the heart of a rich, soft land, richer even than the lands of the tree killers. Look at what we have taken in only 10 days. How much more will we take in a wetlander city? You fear the Shanshan because they have numbers? Remember that I brought every Shido wise one who can channel with me." That she could not channel herself seldom occurred to her now. Soon that lack would be remedied. "We are as strong as any force these wetlanders can send against us, even if they do have flying lizards." She sniffed forcefully to show what she thought of those. None of them had seen one, nor any of the scouts, but nearly every prisoner had been full of the ridiculous tales. "After we find the other septs, we will take this land for our own. All of it. We will extract a 10-fold repayment from the Aes Sedai, and we will find Kadar and make him die screaming for mercy." That should have rallied them, restored their hearts, as she had had to do before. Not one woman's face changed. Not one. "And there is the Karakarn," Tion said calmly. "Unless you have given up your plan to marry him." "I have given up nothing," Savanna replied irritably. "The man, and more important, the power that came with him, would be hers some day, somehow, whatever it took." Smoothing her voice, she went on, "Rand Althor is hardly of consequence now, at least to these blind simpletons. With him in her hands, anything would be possible for her. I do not intend to stand here all day discussing my bridal wreath. I have matters to see to that are important." As she stalked away from them through the gloom toward the doors of the stable, an unpleasant thought suddenly occurred to her. She was alone with these women. How far could she trust them now? Desane's death remained all too vivid in her mind. The wise one had been butchered using the one power. By the women behind her, among others. The thought twisted her belly tight. She listened for the faint rustle of straw that would announce feet following her and heard nothing. Were they just standing there, watching? She refused to look over her shoulder. Keeping the same slow pace required only a little effort. She would not display fear and shame herself. Yet when she pushed one of the tall doors open on its well-oiled hinges and stepped into bright midday light, she could not stop from drawing a relieved breath. Ephalin was pacing outside, Shufa draped around her neck, bow cased on her back, spears and buckler in hand. The gray-haired woman turned abruptly, the worry on her face fading only a little at sight of Savanna. The leader of all the Shido maidens, and she let her distress show? She was not Jumai, but she had come with Savanna using the excuse that Savanna spoke as the chief until a new chief of the Shido could be chosen. Savanna was sure that Ephalin suspected that would never happen. Ephalin knew where the power lay, and when to keep her mouth closed. "Bury him deeply and hide the grave," Savanna told her. Ephalin nodded, signaling the maidens ringing the stable to their feet, and they vanished inside behind her. Savanna studied the building, with its sharp-peaked red roof and blue walls, then turned to the field in front of it. A low stone fence with a single opening right before the stable enclosed a circle of hard-packed dirt perhaps 100 paces across. The wetlanders had used it for training horses. Why it had been placed so far from everything else, surrounded by trees so tall that Savannah still sometimes stared at them, she had not thought to ask the former owners, but the isolation served her purposes. The maidens with a Fallon were those who had captured the Shanchan. No one not here knew he existed, or would know. Were the other wise ones talking in there, about her, in front of the maidens? What were they saying? She would not wait on them or anyone. They came out of the stable just as she started off toward the forest, Somerin and the others, and followed her into the trees, arguing among themselves about the Shanchan and Kadar, and where the rest of the Shido had been sent. Not about her, but then they would not where she could listen. What she did hear made her grimace. There were over 300 wise ones with the Jumai, and it was the same whenever 3 or 4 started talking. Where were the rest of the septs, and had Kadar been a spear hurled by Randall Thor? And how many Shanchan were there, and even did they really ride lizards? Lizards? These women had been with her from the first. She had guided their feet step by step, but they believed they had helped plan every move, believed they knew the destination. If she was losing them now... The forest gave way to a huge clearing that could have swallowed the circle back at the stables 50 times over, and Savannah felt ill-temper slipping away as she stopped to look. Low hills rose to the north, and mountains a few leagues beyond them were capped with clouds, great masses of white streaked with dark gray. She had never seen so many clouds in her life. Closer at hand, thousands of Jumai went about the day's work. The ring of hammer on anvil rose from blacksmiths, and sheep and goats were being slaughtered for the evening meal, their bleating mixed with the laughter of the children as they ran at play. Given more time to prepare for their flight from Kinslayer's dagger than the other septs, the Jumai had brought the flocks gathered in Kyrian and added to them here. Many people had set up their tents, but there was no need. Colorful structures nearly filled the clearing like a large wetlander village, tall barns and stables, a large forge and the squat roofs that had sheltered servants, all painted red and blue, surrounding the great roof itself. The manor house, that was called, 3 floors high beneath a dark green tile roof, all of it a paler green trimmed with yellow, atop a broad man-made stone hill 10 paces tall. Jumai and Gaishine climbed the long ramp that led to the great building's door and walked the ornately carved balconies that ringed it. The stone walls and palaces she had seen in Kyrin had not impressed her half so much. This one was painted like a wagon of the Lost Ones, but even so, marvelous. She should have realized that with so many trees, these people could afford to build anything of wood. Could no one but she see how fat this land was? More white-clad Gaishine scurried about their tasks than any 20 septs had ever had before, nearly half as many as there were Jumai. No one complained about making wetlanders Gaishine anymore. They were so docile. A wide-eyed young man in rough-sewn white hurried past, clutching a basket, gaping at the people around him and stumbling over the hem of his robe. Savannah smiled. That one's father had called himself the lord of this place, and blustered that she and her people would be hunted down, by children of all things, for this outrage. Yet now he wore white and worked as hard as his son, as did his wife and his daughters and his other sons. The women had possessed many fine gems and beautiful silks, and Savannah had only taken the first pick for herself. A fat land, so soft it oozed rich oils. The women behind her had stopped short to talk among themselves at the edge of the trees. She caught what they were saying, and it turned her mood again. "How many Aes Sedai fight for these Shanchan?" Tion was saying. "We must learn that." Somerin and Modara murmured agreement. "I do not think it matters," Rialla put in. At least her contrariness extended to the others, too. "I do not think they will fight unless we attack them. Remember, they did nothing until we moved against them. Not even to defend themselves." And when they did, Mara said sourly, 23 of us died. And more than 10,000 Al-Gaid Siswai did not return either. Here we have little more than a third of that number, even counting the brotherless. She soaked the last word in scorn. That was Randall Thor's work, Savannah told them sharply. Instead of thinking what he did against us, think what we can do when he is ours. When he is mine, she thought. The Aes Sedai had been able to take and hold him as long as they had, and she had something the Aes Sedai had not, else they would have used it. Remember instead that we had the Aes Sedai beaten until he took their side. Aes Sedai are nothing. Once again, her effort to strengthen their hearts produced no visible effect. All they could remember was that the spears had been broken trying to capture Randall Thor, and they with them. Modara might have been staring into the grave of all her sept, and even Teon frowned uneasily, doubtless recalling that she too had run like a frightened goat.
"Wise ones," a man's voice said behind Savannah, "I have been sent to ask for your judgment."
Instantly every woman's face regained its equanimity. What she could not do, he had done with his very presence. No wise one would allow any but another wise one to see her out of countenance. Alaris stopped stroking her hair, which she had pulled over her shoulder. Plainly none of them recognized him. Savannah thought she did. He regarded them gravely, with green eyes much older than his smooth face. He had full lips, but there was a set to his mouth, as if he had forgotten how to smile.
"I am Kinwin, of the Meriden, wise ones. The Jumai say we may not take our full share from this place because we are not Jumai, but it is because they will have less, since we are two for every Jumai Al-Gaid Siswai. The Brotherless ask your judgment, wise ones."
Now that they knew who he was, some could not hide their dislike of the men who had abandoned clan and sept to come to the Shido, rather than follow Randall Thor, a wetlander and no true Karakarn, as they thought. Teon's face merely went flat, but Rialla's eyes flashed, and Mara teetered on the edge of a scowl. Only Modara showed concern, but then she would have tried to settle a dispute between tree killers. "These six wise ones will give judgment after hearing both sides," Savannah told Kinwin, with a graveness to match his. The other women looked at her, barely concealing their surprise that she intended to stand aside. It had been she who arranged for 10 times the number of Meriden to accompany the Jumai as went with any other sept. She really had suspected Kadar, if not of what he had done, and she had wanted as many spears around her as possible. Besides, they could always die in place of Jumai. She affected surprise at the other's surprise. "It would not be fair for me to take part, since my own sept is involved," she told them before turning back to the green-eyed man. "They will give fair judgment, Kinwin, and I am certain they will speak in favor of the Meriden." The other women gave her hard looks before Teon motioned abruptly for Kinwin to lead the way. He had to tear his eyes away from Savannah to comply. Wearing a faint smile, he had been staring at her, not Somerin. She watched them vanish into the mass of people moving about the manor grounds. For all their misliking the Brotherless, and her making predictions to the man about their decision, the chances were they would decide that way. Either way, Kinwin would remember and tell the others of his so-called society. The Jumai were already in her belt pouch, but anything that tied the Meriden to her was welcome. Turning, Savannah strode back into the trees, though not toward the stable. Now that she was alone, she could see to something much more important than the Brotherless. She checked what she had tucked into her skirt at the small of her back, where her shawl hid it. She would have felt if it slipped a hair, but she wanted to touch its smooth length with her fingertips. No wise one would dare think her less than they once she used that, perhaps today. And one day it would give her Randall Thor. After all, if Kadar had lied in one thing, maybe he had lied in others. Through a blur of tears, Galina Kasban glared at the wise one shielding her, as if there were any need for the slender woman's shield. Right then she could not have so much as embraced the source. Sitting cross-legged on the ground between two squatting maidens, Belinda adjusted her shawl and gave a thin smile, as if she knew Galina's thoughts. Her face was narrow and fox-like, and her hair and eyebrows had been bleached nearly white by the sun. Galina wished she had crushed her skull instead of merely slapping her. It had not been an attempt at escape, merely more frustration than she could bear. Her days began and ended with exhaustion, every day more than the last. She could not remember how long since they had stuffed her into that coarse black robe. The days ran together like an everlasting stream. A week, a month, maybe not that long, surely not more. She wished she had never touched Belinda. If the woman had not stuffed rags into her mouth to silence her sobbing, she would have begged to be allowed to carry rocks again, or move a pile of pebbles stone by stone, or any of the tortures they filled her hours with. Anything rather than this. Only Galina's head stuck out of the leather sack that hung suspended from the stout limb of an oak. Directly beneath the sack, coals glowed in a bronze brazier, a slow burn, heating the air inside the sack. She huddled in that sweltering heat with her thumbs tied to her toes, sweat slicking her nakedness. Her hair clung damply to her face and she panted, nostrils flaring for air when she was not sobbing. Even so, this would have been better than the endless, senseless, back-breaking labor they subjected her to, except for one thing. Before snugging the neck of the sack beneath her chin, Belinda had emptied a pouch of some fine powder over her, and as she had begun to sweat, it had begun to burn like pepper flung in the eyes. It seemed to coat her from the shoulders down, and oh, light, it burned. That she called on the light measured her desperation, but they had not broken her for all their trying. She would get free, she would, and once she did, she would make these savages pay in blood, rivers of blood, oceans. She would have them all skinned alive. She would... Flinging back her head, she howled. The wadded rags in her mouth muffled the sound. But she howled, and she did not know whether it was a shriek of rage or a scream for mercy. When her howls died and her head fell forward, Belinda and the maidens were on their feet, and Savannah was with them. Galina attempted to stifle her sobbing in front of the golden-haired woman, but she could as soon have plucked the sun from the sky with her fingers. "Listen to her whine and snivel," Savannah sneered, coming to look up at her. Galina tried to put an equal contempt in her own stare. Savannah decked herself with enough jewelry for 10 women. She wore her blouse unlaced to nearly bare her bosom, except for all those mismatched necklaces, and breathed deep when men looked at her. Galina tried, but contempt was hard to manage with tears rolling down her cheeks along with her sweat. She shook with weeping, making the sack sway. "This Datsang is tough as an old ewe," Belinda cackled. "But I always found even the toughest old ewe was made tender if cooked slowly with the right herbs. When I was a maiden, I softened stone dogs with enough cooking." Galina closed her eyes. "Oceans of blood to pay for—" The sack lurched, and Galina's eyes popped open as it began to settle. The maidens had undone the rope running over the limb, and the pair of them were lowering her slowly. Frantically she thrashed about, trying to look down, and almost began sobbing anew with relief when she saw that the brazier had been moved aside. With Belinda's talk of cooking, that would be Belinda's fate, Galina decided. Tied to a spit and turned over a fire until her juices dripped. That to begin. With a thud that made Galina grunt, the leather bag hit the ground and toppled over. As unconcerned as if they were handling a sack of potatoes, the maidens tumbled her out onto the brown weeds, sliced the cords that held her thumbs and toes, plucked the gag from between her teeth. Dirt and dead leaves stuck to the sweat coating her. She very much wanted to stand, to meet them all eye to eye and glare for glare. Instead, she rose only as far as hands and knees, then dug her fingers into the mulch of the forest floor, dug her toes in. Any further, and she would not be able to stop her hands from flying to soothe her red, flaming skin. Her sweat felt like the juice of ice peppers. All she could do was crouch there and quiver,
try to work some moisture back into her mouth, and daydream of what she would do to these savages. "I believed you were stronger than this," Savannah said above her in thoughtful tones. "But perhaps Belinda is right. Perhaps you are soft enough now. If you swear to obey me, you can stop being Dutsung. Perhaps you will not even have to be Geishine. Will you swear to obey me in all things?"
"Yes!"
The hoarse word flew from Galina's tongue without hesitation, though she had to swallow before speaking more.
"I will obey you, I swear it!"
And so she would obey, until they gave the opening she needed. Was this all that had been necessary? An oath she would have made the first day? Savannah would learn what it was like to hang over hot coals. Oh, yes, she... "Then you will not object to swearing your oath on this," Savannah said, tossing something down in front of her. Galena's scalp crawled as she stared at it. A white rod like polished ivory, a foot long and no thicker than her wrist. Then she saw the flowing marks carved into the end toward her, numerals used in the Age of Legends. 111. She had thought it was the oath rod somehow stolen from the White Tower. That also was marked, but with the numeral 3, which some thought stood for the 3 oaths. Maybe this was not what it seemed. Maybe. Yet no hooded viper from the drowned lands coiled there could have frozen her so still.
"A fine oath, Savannah. When did you intend to tell the rest of us?"
That voice jerked Galena's head up. It could have pulled her eyes away from a hooded viper, too. Therava appeared among the trees, leading a dozen cold-faced wise ones. When they stopped behind her, confronting Savannah, every woman present except for the maidens had been there when Galena was sentenced to wear the black robe. A word from Therava, a short nod from Savannah, and the maidens departed swiftly. Sweat still oozed from Galena, but suddenly the air seemed cold. Savannah glanced at Belinda, who avoided her eye. Savannah's lip curled, half sneer, half snarl, and she planted fists on hips. Galena did not understand where she found the nerve, a woman who could not channel at all. Some of these women possessed not inconsiderable strength. No, she could not afford to think of them only as wilders if she was to escape and have her revenge. Therava and Somerin were stronger than any woman in the tower, and any of them could have been Aes Sedai easily. But Savannah faced them defiantly. "It seems you rendered justice quickly," she said in a voice dry as dust.
"The matter was simple," Tion replied calmly. "The Meriden received the justice they deserved."
"And they were told they received it in spite of your attempt to sway us," Rialla added with some heat. Savannah nearly did snarl at that.
Therava would not be diverted from her purpose, though. In one swift step she reached Galena, gripped a handful of her hair and jerked her up to her knees, bent her head back. Therava was not the tallest of these women by at least a head, yet she loomed taller than most men, staring down with a hawk's eyes, driving away every thought of revenge or defiance. The white streaks touching her dark red hair only made her face more commanding. Galena's hands clenched into fists on her thighs, nails digging into her palms. Even the burning of her skin paled under that stare. She had daydreamed about breaking every one of these women, making them plead for death, laughing as she denied their begging. About everyone except Therava. At night Therava filled her dreams, and all Galena could do was try to flee. The only escape was to wake screaming. Galena had broken strong men and strong women, but she stared up at Therava wide-eyed and whined.
"This one has no honor to shame," Therava almost spat the words. "If you want her broken, Savannah, let me have her. When I am done, she will obey without the need for your friend Kedar's toy."
Savannah spoke up heatedly, denying friendship with this Kedar, whoever he was, and Rialla barked that Savannah had brought him to the others, and others began arguing about whether the binder would work any better than the traveling box. A small part of Galena's mind seized on mention of the traveling box. She had heard it spoken of before, longed to lay hands on it, if only for a moment. With a Turangreal that enabled her to travel, however imperfectly it seemed to work, she would be able to...
Even hope of escape could not stand against thoughts of what Thurava would do to her if the others decided to give in to the woman's request. When the hawk-eyed wise one loosed her hair to join the argument, Galena hurled herself at the rod, landing flat on her belly. Anything, even having to obey Savannah, was better than being handed over to Thurava. If she had not been shielded, she would have channeled to operate the rod herself. No sooner did her fingers close on the smooth rod than Thurava's foot came down on it hard, trapping her hands painfully against the ground. None of the wise ones so much as glanced at her where she lay writhing, trying futilely to pull free. She could not make herself pull too hard. Dimly she could recall making rulers pale with fear, but she did not dare disturb this woman's foot. "If she is to swear," Thurava said, staring hard at Savannah, "it should be to obey all of us here." The others nodded, some voicing agreement, all but Belinda, and she pursed her lips thoughtfully. Savannah stared back just as hard. "Very well," she acceded finally. "But me first among us. I am not only a wise one, I speak as the clan chief." Thurava smiled thinly. "So you do. Two among us first, Savannah. You and I." Not a whisper of defiance faded from Savannah's face, but she nodded. Grudgingly. Only then did Thurava move her foot. The light of Sidar surrounded her, and a flow of spirit touched the numerals at the end of the rod in Galena's hands, just as was done with the oath rod. For an instant Galena hesitated, flexing mashed fingers. It felt the same as the oath rod, too. Not quite like ivory, not quite like glass, distinctly cool on her palms. If it was a second oath rod, it could be used to remove any oath she swore now. If she were given the opportunity. She did not want to take the chance, did not want to swear to Thurava in any case. Always before this in her life, she had commanded. Life since her capture had been misery, but Thurava would make her a lapdog. Yet if she did not, would they let Thurava break her? She could not find the smallest particle of doubt that the woman would do just that. Utterly. Under the light and by my hope of salvation and rebirth, she no longer believed in the light or a hope of salvation, and there was no need to speak more than a simple promise, but they expected a strong oath. I swear to obey every wise one present here in all things, and first among them Thurava and Savannah. The last hope that this binder was something else vanished, as Galena felt the oath settle on her, as if she suddenly wore a garment that covered her far too tightly, from her scalp to the soles of her feet. Throwing back her head, she screamed. In part, that was because it suddenly seemed as if the burning of her skin was being pressed deep into her flesh, but mainly it was pure despair. "Be quiet," Thurava said sharply. "I do not want to listen to you wailing." Galena's teeth clicked shut, nearly biting her tongue, and she struggled to swallow her sobs. Nothing but obedience was possible now. Thurava frowned at her. "Let us see if this truly works," she muttered, bending closer. "Have you planned violence against any wise one here? Answer truthfully and ask to be punished if you have. The penalty for violence against a wise one," she added like an afterthought, "can be to be killed like an animal." She drew a finger expressively across her throat, then gripped her belt knife with the same hand. Gulping air in horrified panic, Galena shied back from the woman. She could not take her eyes away from Thurava's, though, and she could not stop the words that chattered through her teeth.
"I did against all of you. Please punish me for it."
Would they kill her now? After all of this, was she to die here? "It seems this binder does as your friend claimed after all, Savannah." Plucking the rod from Galena's limp hands, Thurava tucked it behind her belt as she straightened. "It also seems that you will wear white after all, Galena Kazban." For some reason she gave a pleased smile at that, but she issued other commands, too. "You will behave meekly as a guy shine should. If a child tells you to jump, you will jump unless one of us has said otherwise. And you will not touch Sidar or channel unless one of us tells you. Release the shield on her, Belinda." The shield vanished, and Galena knelt there, staring hollowly. The source shone just out of sight, tantalizing, and she could have sprouted wings as easily as she could stretch out for it. Bracelets clattered as Savannah shifted her shawl in anger.
"You take too much on yourself, Therava. That is mine. Give it to me."
She held out her hand, but Therava merely folded her arms beneath her breasts. "There have been meetings among the wise ones," the stern-eyed woman told Savannah. "We have reached certain decisions." The women who had come with her gathered behind her, all of them facing Savannah, and Belinda hurried to join them.
"Without me?" Savannah snapped. "Do any of you dare reach a decision without me?"
Her tone remained as strong as ever, but her eyes flickered to the rod in Therava's belt, and Galena thought there was a touch of uneasiness there. Another time she would have been delighted to see it.
"One decision had to be reached without you," Tian said in a flat voice.
"As you so often point out, you speak as the clan chief," Emerus added, a mocking light in her big gray eyes. "Sometimes wise ones must speak without a clan chief listening, or someone who speaks as a chief."
"We decided," Therava said, "that just as a clan chief must have a wise one to advise him, so must you have a wise one's advice. I will advise you."
Gathering her shawl around her, Savannah studied the women confronting her. Her expression was unreadable. How did she do it? They could crush her like an egg beneath a hammer.
"And what advice do you offer me, Therava?" she said at last in an icy voice. "My strong advice is that we move without delay," Therava replied, as cool as Savannah. "These Shan-Chan are too close and too many. We should move north into these mountains of mist and establish a hold. From there we can send parties to find the other septs. It may take long to reunite the Shido, Savannah. Your wetlander friend may have scattered us to the nine corners of the world. Until we do that, we are vulnerable."
"We will move tomorrow."
If Galena had not been sure she knew Savannah inside and out, she would have thought the woman sounded petulant as well as angry. Those green eyes flashed.
"But east. That also is away from the Shan-Chan, and the lands to the east are in turmoil, ripe for plucking."
There was a long silence. Then Therava nodded. "East," she said the words softly, the softness of silk laid over steel.
"But remember that clan chiefs have lived to regret rejecting a wise one's advice too often. You may as well."
The threat on her face was plain as that in her voice, yet Savannah laughed.
"You remember, Therava. All of you remember. If I am left for the vultures, so will you be. I have made assurance of that."
The other women exchanged worried glances, all but Therava, and Modara and Norlia frowned. Slumped on her knees, whimpering and trying in vain to soothe her skin with her hands, Galena found herself wondering what these threats meant. It was a small thought, worming its way through bitterness and self-pity. Anything she could use against these women would be welcome, if she dared use it. A bitter thought. Abruptly, she realized that the sky was turning dark. Billowing clouds were rolling down from the north, streaked gray and black, obscuring the sun. And beneath the cloud fell flurries of snow swirling in the air. None reached the ground. Few fell as far as the treetops, but Galena gaped.
Snow? Had the great lord loosened his grip on the world for some reason?
The wise ones stared at the sky, too, mouths hanging open as if they had never seen clouds, much less snow.
"What is this, Galena Kazban?" Therava demanded. "Speak if you know."
She did not look away from the sky until Galena told her it was snow, and when she did, it was to laugh.
"I always thought the men who ran down Lehman Tree Killer lied about snow. This could not hamper a mouse."
Galena clamped her jaws shut on explaining about snowfalls, aghast that her instinct had been to curry favor, aghast as well at the small pang of pleasure that keeping the information back gave.
"I am the highest of the Red Aja," she reminded herself. "I sit on the Supreme Council of the Black Aja."
They sounded like lies.
This was not fair.
If we are done here, Savannah said, I will take the Gaishine back to the great roof and see her put in white. You can remain and stare at the snow if you wish. Her tone was so smooth, like butter in the tub, that no one would have thought her at dagger's points only moments earlier. She looped her shawl over her elbows and adjusted some of her necklaces. Nothing in the world concerned her more.
We will take care of the Gaishine, Therava told her just as smoothly. Since you speak as the chief, you have a long day and most of the night ahead of you if we are to move tomorrow.
For an instant Savannah's eyes flashed again, but Therava merely snapped her fingers and gestured sharply at Galina before turning to go.
Come with me, she said, and stop pouting.
Head down, Galina scrambled to her feet and scurried after Therava and the other women who could channel.
Pouting? She might have been scowling, but never pouting.
Her thoughts scrabbled like rats in a cage, finding no hope of escape.
There had to be one. There had to be.
One thought that surfaced in the middle of that turmoil almost made her begin weeping again. Were Gaishine robes softer than the scratchy black wool she had been forced to wear so far? There had to be a way out. A hasty glance back through the trees showed Savannah still standing there, glaring after them. Overhead the clouds swirled, and the falling snow melted like Galena's hopes.